Change.org went viral, Nash Action Network, and some of us hit the streets. I remember the night we had the first big rally, 30,000 people. On that afternoon, Governor Scott asked to meet. He flew in and met and said that he was going to appoint a special prosecutor. I will say publicly that I did not trust Governor Scott. I did not trust the appointment. I want to congratulate him and the prosecutor for being what they should be. If we did not get this far, we would condemn them. We must say that despite the fact that we have different political parties and different political persuasions, that tonight maybe America could come together and say that only the facts should matter when you're dealing with a loss of life. And I think that the prosecutor and I think that the governor did not make a decision based on public pressure, but I think they decided to review it based on public pressure. I think that they would not be irresponsible enough to proceed with a prosecution based on pressure. But had there not been pressure, there would not have been a second look. And I think that that credit should go to the nameless, faceless people, black, white, Latino, and Asian, all over this country that put hoods on and said, take another look at this, and that look has led to where we are tonight. They will attack the big names, and they will give credit to the big names, but it's the unknown people that took their time and money and stood up and said that that could be my son, that could be my grandson. And because of a second look, even conservatives on the other side of the political spectrum said, no, we're going to take a second look and do what is right. They've charged him with a serious crime. He deserves a fair trial. We do not want anybody high-fiving tonight. There's no victory here. There's no winners here. They've lost their son. This is not about gloating. This is about pursuing justice. We have not won anything. All we have done is establish that we must have the right to redress and justice in this country. So we will not be gloating around here. We are still mourning with this family. We will monitor the trial every step of the way. We will stand by and make sure that the rights of all are not violated. But this is not a night for celebration. It is a night that should have never happened in the first place. And we are trying to make sure that something happens that this will not happen again. Are we happy with the charge? Are we happy with the results? I would say that we must say that if Americans come together, they can achieve things. I remember as I bring Attorney Crump, as we marched in Selma, I remember reading 44 years ago, a man was asked after they got the Voting Rights Act, how did he feel? And he said, we ain't where we ought to be. We ain't where we gonna be. We ain't where we wanna be. But thank God, we ain't where we was. Tonight, we don't know where it will lead, but at least we have a shot at this family having the right redress. And that is because of first the courage of Attorney Parks and the battling attorney Ben Crump.
The Reverend Al Sharpton speaking just moments ago at a news conference with the parents of Trayvon Martin, Sabrina Fulton, and Tracy Martin, as well as Ben Crump, the family attorney. As Reverend Sharpton said, this is not a time for celebration. There is no victory. There are no winners. It's not about gloating. It's about justice. As we said earlier, Angela Corey, the special prosecutor who was appointed to investigate the killing of Trayvon Martin, has tonight announced charges of second-degree murder against George Zimmerman, the man who shot Trayvon Martin 45 days ago. Zimmerman is in custody in Florida in an undisclosed location and will be facing a judge very soon. This has been a special report of the events around the Trayvon Martin case. We will have an update on the 11:30 edition of the WBAI Evening News. I'm Andrea Sears. Thank you and good night.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country. A media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI New York. The time is 7:01, time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined by Mike.
Hello.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Dot Red. Red Hag.
Hello.
Jim.
Ah!
And, okay, Jim. Down in Philadelphia is Bernie S.
Ah! From Philadelphia.
Yeah, let's all start screaming. It's been one of those days where you feel like screaming. I know that. Lots of people running around, all kinds of news breaking and things like that. I was just talking to the folks outside saying that, you know, maybe we should rethink justice in this country and have a 45-day waiting period after every crime is committed so that people have a chance to really think about what it is they did, and you can also gauge how they're going to react, like what they're going to do next. Are they going to commit more crimes? It's might be something worth, you know, Florida is always at the head of this kind of progressive thinking.
When you said the people outside, I thought you meant people like on Wall Street, and I would be thrilled if they would be charged only 45 days after they commit their crime. So,
well, no, here's the thing. The clock resets when they commit a new crime, so that's another 45 days, so they'll never be imprisoned. It's a unique system, and you can play it rather well. But, probably not. Well, we'll see what happens. Interesting times. Interesting day here. We're here to talk about all kinds of technological advances and regressions and the various other things that we cover in this hour. We'll be taking phone calls, things like that. The Hope Conference is plowing along. All kinds of new talks have been submitted. Thanks, listeners, who have responded to our appeals over the last couple of weeks and submitted talk ideas. We've got some really good ones. We'll be releasing a whole bunch more in the next few days, couple of weeks. Isn't that right, Mike? We have a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of cool things out there.
There's so many I can't even keep track of them, but that's a good problem to have.
I don't want to give away details because they haven't been finalized yet. We have to verify things with the submitters, but I will say that we're getting everything from people who work in secret government agencies to people who are at the top of various corporations, to students, to lawyers, to activists of all sorts, to anonymous hackers, both with capital A and lowercase a. It's really cool. It's going to be the most amazing gathering of minds and mischief that I think we've had yet. This is our ninth conference, HELP number 9, July 13, 14, and 15 at the Hotel Pennsylvania. It's always fun.
We might as well also point out that if you like to sell things at the conference, vendor table information is now on HELP number 9 mm-hmm. Website.
What kinds of things do people sell besides Club Mate, which we sell? But
books. People sell books. Okay. People sell hardware. People sell kits.
Mm-hmm.
People sell things that we have never seen before.
Yeah, they surprise us sometimes with some of the things that they come up with. So,
or you could just distribute leaflets. Mm-hmm. Some people do that as well.
Absolutely. The email address, if you want to submit a talk idea, there's still plenty of time for that. And I wouldn't say plenty of time. There's still time. We're filling up the schedule. We're going to have over 100 talks, but you'd be amazed how quickly that fills up. The address, speakers@hope.net. I think you can get any simpler than that. If you have an idea for some kind of a project, projects@hope.net, some kind of a workshop or something like that you'd like to try and have happen. It's a hacker conference, so anything is possible. So we're open to all kinds of ideas. Outright.
Yeah, that's a really good thing to point out. Hacker conferences especially are participatory things. You don't just go around and watch. You know, there's lots of doing and everyone interacting, and the projects and workshops are an amazing part of HOPE. So
and the people you meet in general at the conferences, that's always one of the great things about going to these conferences. It's not just about the talks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can watch videos of the talks anytime, but it's also about the people and the people you interact with and the people you get to meet. So.
It's great just standing on 7th Avenue at 3 o'clock in the morning with about 50 other people that are all part of the conference. And everybody's just sort of hanging out, you know, talking about various things, watching the world go by. That's what the whole weekend is like, people just hanging out in various parts of the hotel. And it's right across the street from Penn Station, so it's a very busy area all the time. And the talks are great to experience live, to be there, as are all the things going on in the second floor as well. But it's all about the interactions, all about the people you meet, because you do wind up staying in touch with them for a very long time. The address, if you want to register, www.hope.net. Again, this month we have a special promotion where 10% of the ticket sales go to the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So if you buy a ticket, 10% of that will be donated to the EFF. And I think that's really a good way of saying that you support what they do. We've had them on the show multiple times. We'll have them again. And they are going to have a bunch of talks at this conference as well. They've been doing incredible work over the last couple of decades. But I think it's stepped up a lot recently because so many things are happening on so many levels. There's this one case that I just read yesterday. Federal Appeals Court rejected a dangerous interpretation of the federal anti-hacking law, dismissing charges that would have criminalized any employee's use of a company's computers in violation of corporate policy. Yeah, basically you could be locked up for that. The EFF filed an amicus brief in that case, which is U.S. versus Nozal, urging the court to come to this conclusion as part of its ongoing work to ensure fair application of the Federal Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Bernie, have you been following that?
Yeah. We've all been following this for years, this whole terms of service violation thing, whether that would incur a potential criminal prosecution. And I'm glad to hear that, but it's just a circuit court, and other circuit courts have ruled the other way, so it looks like this might be going to the Supreme Court, and we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, it's always fun.
So if I use my employer's computer at work to, surf Facebook or something, clearly I can be fired for that if my employer doesn't want me to. But you're telling me I can be thrown in jail as well?
You know what? I thought you were talking about terms of service violations, but you could be. I mean, you could. It depends on the terms of service. There's criminal. There was also a decision this week, and I was confusing the two decisions, conflating them, that a terms of service violation is not considered by this one circuit, federal circuit, a potential criminal offense? Are you talking about the thing where employers can't ask you for your Facebook?
No, that's something else. That's a whole different case.
There's a lot of cases.
That's the thing. There are so many cases. I think that's a tactic. There are so many cases that you can't keep track of them all, and you wind up not paying attention to ones that really wind up, kicking you in the ass at some point.
And yeah, this is a very important one to pay attention to, because if you could basically be charged for federal crime for violating your employer's rules, whatever they might be, they've basically elevated corporate policy to the severity of federal law. That would be horrible if that were to succeed.
You know, if you're a corporation or you're a group of corporations like the MPAA and the RIAA, they're throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks, right? So, of course, there's a lot of cases. This didn't work. Maybe this other way will work.
Well, the gist of it is that without organizations like EFF around to pay attention and to file amicus briefs when necessary and to fight in court whenever they can, we'd be in much worse shape. And we still could be in much worse shape because this never goes away. They will always come back and try and get their foot in the door a different way. So you always have to be alert, and it's really important to recognize this and to support these organizations.
I mean, the other nice thing about the EFF is they understand the technical aspects of it, right? So so not only are they there to protect our rights and protect our privacy, but also they have an understanding of what's going on, which often, lawmakers don't. So it's up to the EFF in a way to monitor what the lawmakers are doing and make sure, because the lawmakers may have no idea what it is that they're actually doing,
and
unfortunately.
They're open to listening, too. So if you know something that maybe they're not quite getting, or maybe they don't see the importance of it yet, they'll listen if you contact them and say, hey, this is something coming down the pike that could really be a bad law, and we need to fight it, or we need to be educated about it. So, yeah, it's great to have this dialogue. And again, the conference is a great place to actually put faces to the names and make contacts and stay in touch and build resistance to all of this, because we've been fighting these battles for so long, and it's just it's always interesting, but a bit scary at the same time. Don't you think, Bernie?
Very scary. But we'll be hearing lots about scary laws and ways to combat them.
Yes. Definitely. Lots of scary laws. We have not just EFF lawyers, but people from different organizations as well, and a lot of people that are on the receiving end of some of these laws.
We even have some speakers who are not lawyers at all.
Yeah, we do. Oh, lots. Lots. I'd say most probably aren't lawyers. But some, there are people that become lawyers because they read the magazine and they listen to the radio show and they realize, hey, lawyers are needed. And people have actually turned into lawyers as a result of listening and reading what we put out.
Yeah, but then they graduate law school with crippling debt and they go work for corporations and they know a lot about the issues and it doesn't help.
Doesn't always happen. Doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes it works out well.
Sometimes it works the other way, too. I know a lawyer who stopped being a lawyer and went fully into hacker stuff full time after attending a few conferences.
Oh, wow. How did that work out?
Apparently well.
I can't imagine that paying off, but okay. whatever you feel like, I guess. Okay, we have some very interesting stories that are out there now. You hear about this? They apparently just came up with this a method of dealing with stolen cell phones. Now, so many people have smartphones these days, and a lot of these people are either losing their cell phones, their smartphones, or having them stolen. And what has happened this week is that major wireless service companies have agreed to disable cell phones after they are reported stolen under a strategy intended to deter the theft and resale of wireless devices. They'll begin blocking stolen devices within 6 months. That's according to the FCC Commission Chairman Julian Genachowski, who said this at a news conference yesterday, along with NYPD Commissioner Raymond Kelly. Carriers with the push of a button, I don't know why it takes them 6 months to push the button, will be able to take highly prized stolen instruments and turn them into worthless pieces of plastic. What we're doing, some of us already think they are worthless pieces of plastic, but what we're doing is drying up the market for stolen cell phones and other types of devices. It's like draining the swamp to fight malaria. Yeah, we think this is going to have a significant impact. You're kind of really putting yourself up on a pedestal there. Okay, they're stolen cell phones. Is this really anything new? They always had this ability.
Is it that they're going to start doing this in 6 months, or that after it's reported. I assume that
I think they're not going to start doing this for 6 months.
But then, because the thing is that with all cell phones, right, when you lose your cell phone, they have a record of the kind of identifier of the cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume what they're going to do is they're going to, if a cell phone is reported stolen, they're going to block any cell phones with identifier from using their network, which, I mean, it's not a bad metaphor, right?
No, but I can't believe they've... Well, the malaria thing is a ridiculous metaphor, but I can't believe it took them this long to come up with something like this, because you remember the guy in England when the 7/7 bombings, when they basically had a bunch of people that were blowing up buses and trains and things like that. One guy went to Italy, put a new SIM card in his phone, turned it on, and was immediately caught because it wasn't the SIM card, it was the ID of the phone that was able to be identified. Now, if somebody steals your phone, obviously the same capability exists where that ID can be identified and disabled.
So I had a phone once, and for whatever reason, someone who wasn't me kept reporting it stolen, and so I would have to call the carrier and be like, yo, the phone's in my pocket where it's always been.
Wait, who did you steal it from?
From myself, apparently. It was very strange, and I would have to go through this long argument telling them that, no, in fact, it was neither lost or stolen, and I don't know who they talked to, but it wasn't me. But if they had disabled my phone and then I had to spend hundreds of dollars on a new phone, I would have been even more upset.
Well, yeah, but you know, the person who originally owned the phone that you somehow obtained, they would be upset too, right?
Emmanuel.
Are you saying you didn't steal? Let's just be clear here.
I did not steal the
phone.
This
is a day of justice, Mike, where everything is coming out on the table now. So you definitely did not. You're sure about this? Remember, you were under oath.
Yeah, I bought it from the carrier, that phone.
All right, and they kept reporting it stolen.
Someone who wasn't me kept reporting it stolen.
All right, well, that's an interesting trick. Go ahead, Thanks. Bernie, and then Red Hag.
Cellular carriers used to do this. They used to blacklist what was called the electronic serial number. This is before GSM phones were in the U.S. And if your phone was stolen, you could report it, and it would be on a blacklist that was shared through all the carriers. But sometime in the 90s, they stopped doing that. Why? I don't know. But I think that the carriers have a vested interest in not creating a blacklist, because then all the stolen phones can generate revenue for them, too. I mean, just the average cell phone, stolen or not, generates many hundreds of dollars a year, if not thousands, for the carrier.
Well, now, here's my question. Okay, maybe it is a pain for them to do this. Maybe it's not profitable for them to do this. But by disabling the phone, obviously the person can't make phone calls, but all the personal information that people tend to store on these smartphones, is that disabled too, or do people still have access to all of that?
I think this is just to prevent the phone from working, frankly. It's a little unclear from the article, but to me, it says brick a cell phone. I know of no way you can – there's forensic technologies that can still get the information out of the cell phone. So this isn't protecting your information. This is just preventing your cell phone from being used by the thief or from someone who bought a phone from a thief or from a fence or somebody like that.
Seems like that's a good way to catch the thief, by having them use the phone.
I think if you shut it off, then you can't find them.
I don't think that the carriers necessarily have the capability to remotely wipe a phone. There are solutions out there that will do that, but usually the user has to install it. I don't know if Apple ones have it built in, but anyway, there are ways to remote wipe it, but I don't think it would be within the carrier's capability to do it. But also, you know, a note to the carriers: if you're going to do this, make sure that the person who's reporting it stolen originally had the phone associated with their account, or you're going to have problems like what Mike had. Obviously, if the person was using it and it was registered to their account and they report it stolen, you know, that's a pretty legitimate way to verify that was their phone. But yeah,
I'd definitely be more interested with looking with some sort of solution for them to bring into wipe phones as opposed to simply turn them off, because with these smartphones coming out, you have all this private data. However, I don't know if this will really drain the swamp, so to speak. I have a sneaking suspicion this is really just going to stimulate the market for people figuring out how to modify the actual identifier for their phones.
I would love the opportunity to be able to just make a phone call and shut off anyone's phone I wanted to, and wipe it as well.
Who I'm going to feel bad for, though, are the people who, you know, that someone gets their phone stolen, they sell it immediately on, you know, Craigslist or something to somebody else, and then a few days later that person has a non-working cell phone and no recourse.
See, right away we come up with mischievous applications for this kind of thing.
Well, it's not even a mischievous application. It's just that if somebody buys a stolen cell phone unwittingly, they're going to have problems, right? And there probably won't be any way for them to appeal that.
No, that actually would be a really horrible thing for people, because now that then you could have someone buy a phone, sell it for about the same amount of money, report it stolen, and with their warranty for a lower price, buy a new phone and make a net profit.
All right. Well, speaking of advances in the cell phone world, apparently you can improve just about anything these days by sticking the letters HD in front of it. That's what Sprint apparently is doing, as people increasingly abandon voice calling for texting and emailing. Audio quality has been a bit neglected, to say the least. But Sprint's debut of the HD voice-compatible 4G LTE signal that carriers are starting to kick the quality up a notch. Yeah, okay. The jump from your current phone to HD voice is like switching from dial-up to DSL. But what is it exactly? This article in Gizmodo asks. Normally calls are transmitted on a limited frequency of 300 hertz to 3 to 4 kilohertz, but HD voice is a wideband audio technology expanding that range from 50 hertz to 7 kilohertz and up. This larger frequency essentially means that more sound waves and speech data can be squeezed into a single channel with the excess information stripped out, resulting in clearer calls. You know, it's sort of what we've been talking about for years, like something that maybe people would pay a premium for is actual phone calls that sound like phone calls used to sound like. But I'm not sure. Bernie, I know you're somebody who takes these things with a grain of salt. Do you think this is actually a step forward?
Well, I think it's a step back to where it used to be, where the phone call quality was very good with cellular phones. But then the carriers got greedy as they started overselling the capacity on their networks and then squeezing existing customers into a smaller and smaller bandwidth channel. So, I mean, I'm talking to you on a Sprint phone right now, and my voice is going through a codec, which is an algorithm that, you know, squeezes my voice into a bit stream that's about 3 kilobits per second, which is ridiculous. I should be getting, it used to be really high quality. So they're squeezing us and charging more for it. And this is just, I'm really curious as whether they're going to start charging money for this feature. If they do, it's a real ripoff.
Well, I'm sure I'm speaking for everyone here when I say that we'll wait to see if it actually performs as they say it does. But I just love how HD in front of everything just means that it's better now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that at least sounds like from the article is, since they're using, you know, a wider band channel, there are actually limits information theory limits on how much data you can squeeze through certain channels. So if they're giving it more bandwidth, then it at least is going to be able to send more information. And if they couple that with, you know, fairly good codecs, then, you know, it may sound better.
Well, I mean, I actually suggested this a couple of years ago, and I did suggest that people might be willing to pay more to have better sound quality. Imagine talking on the phone and it sounds like FM radio, like you're talking to somebody and you can both hear each other. You're not talking and the other person is talking at the same time, and neither one of you is listening to the other person. You would have that that two-way function that we used to have on landline. Well, we still do have on landlines, except people don't tend to use them nearly as much.
I for one, will be very happy if after 20 years of building infrastructure and billions of dollars investing in this network, we'll get to a point where phone calls sound like they did 30 years ago.
Well, the thing is, people are so reluctant to even get on the phone. I had a conversation on the air yesterday with Kyle about this. We were talking about how people don't use phones anymore. People are texting back and forth, and all you have to do is pick up the phone and ask a simple question, and it would be the time would be cut by a huge amount. But also just the voice quality. We were talking landline to landline, and not only were we talking landline to landline, both of us were on rotary phones, old rotary phones from the 1960s, and we asked the question at that time, and maybe you guys can help answer this: how many people in the country at that moment do you think were talking on landlines from one rotary phone to another? We were wondering if we might be the only ones left. Do you guys know anybody that still has a rotary phone that uses it?
Ooh.
No. Jim, you do?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. All right. Bernie, how about you?
I have lots of rotary phones, but I don't have a phone line connected to them.
Yeah, you need that, Bernie. You definitely need that. no question about that. You know, we concluded that maybe there are some, you know, stubborn people out there that are still using their rotary phones. But even if you do, the odds of calling somebody else that does that are rather slim.
I think you provided an existence proof for the stubborn people with still using rotary phones.
What does that mean, existence proof?
I mean, you were the ones.
So you think we were the only ones?
I don't know about the only ones, but it's clear there are at least some because you were doing it.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, it'd be interesting to find out. If anyone out there has a rotary phone and uses it on a regular basis, and you call other people who also have rotary phones and use them, pick up the phone, and they're talking on a rotary, I would just like to know.
Why do I want to do that?
Well, I don't know. You don't even have a landline, so
I don't.
You don't get the relevance of.
I could maybe hook up a rotary phone to a Bluetooth and talk over it on my cell phone. Yeah, but why do I want a rotary phone?
It's just not the same.
What's the advantage?
Well, there's no advantage to it. It's just but the phone is probably better quality than anything more modern, and it probably will last longer. I mean, I'm talking about telephones from the 1940s that still work perfectly today. You know?
Well, the technology hasn't changed at all.
Yeah, except good luck using a phone that's only 5 years old today. It's they tend to fall apart a lot quicker, and the quality is not nearly as good.
No, I meant for the landline phones, the technology hasn't really changed. Mm-hmm. The switching technology's changed, but the way that you actually connect to the phone network hasn't changed.
Well, it depends. I mean, obviously, you have to use some kind of a phone, not a VoIP a phone company. You have to use something that uses the actual wires from the CO And you can still have lousy voice quality on a landline. You can still do it.
You do know that it's digital. You know, it's analog from you to the CO, but it's digital from the CO to CM.
I'm not anti-digital. I'm not speaking against digital technology at all. But I'm saying that we compromise too much on the actual quality. If you listen to a cell phone call, obviously it's not nearly as good. It's got nothing to do with it being digital. It has to do with the bandwidth being so compressed and so little being allocated to the voice path that it just sounds awful. But people are used to it, so they tolerate it.
Yeah. Speaking of phones that nobody uses anymore, did you see the article I sent about the New York payphones? That they're going to replace them?
Well, you know, we talked about this a few weeks ago on
really?
The show.
Oh,
yes,
well,
we did. Yeah. Apparently, they're going to be replacing every single payphone kiosk with, they actually said this, every payphone, not kiosk, just every payphone will be replaced by some kind of a data terminal. I kind of doubt it. I doubt they're actually going to go through and do it to every single payphone, but it will be interesting.
Just get rid of the rest, right?
I just want to say that I totally love this idea for how horrible it sounds. I mean, have you ever seen payphones, what they look like after they've been on the streets for just 5 months? They get beaten, bashed, you can have touchscreen devices. No way.
Yeah. Look at our phone. Our phones are lighting up like crazy. We didn't even give out the phone number. Sometimes we give out the phone number and we don't get this many calls. So obviously we're touching upon some sore points here.
People want to talk about phones.
Maybe they're calling us from rotary phones. That's
maybe.
Possible, too. Yeah, it's really pretty amazing. I'd like to read some listener letters because we have gotten a few. But you know, first I want to tell a story because this is something that happened to me only a few days ago. If you follow my Twitter account, you might have seen me going through this living hell. I was basically just trying to download some music legally. I do this. What I do is I buy albums and download them and listen to them. You know, does anybody else do that?
Of course.
Yeah, I do that.
You do. And you pay for them. Basically, it works. It can work until it doesn't. And this is what happened to me. I was going to Amazon, which is one of the places I go to, and the album that I wanted to download, and you know what? I'm going to start, I'm actually going to play some of this right now. This is the music I was trying to download. Not exactly top 40. But this is the music I could not get on Amazon. For some reason, this album was not there. Very popular. It's a Bob Dylan album from the 1970s, I believe. And I just wanted this album, you know, no other reason. And it was on the Amazon.co.uk site, though. You could get it in England. You couldn't get it in the United States. It was released in the United States, obviously, but you couldn't. I'd have to buy the CD and wait for it to show up before I could actually listen to the music. And I wanted something a little faster than that. Amazon.co.uk would not sell it to me because I was not in the UK. I was not allowed to download music from the UK, even if I was willing to pay for it. And it just struck me as ridiculous. So I said, okay, you know what? I'm gonna play by the rules here. I could pirate this thing in 5 seconds and pay nothing for it, but I want to pay for it. I want to download it. I want to do the right thing. So I started looking all over the place and I went to, I have iTunes. I went to the iTunes store and, boy, that was a lot of fun because, you can't just buy music on the iTunes store. You have to log in, and I logged in with the information that I had, and apparently I didn't have the right Apple ID, whatever the Apple ID is. So I asked, okay, here's my email address. Well, you can't use that because that's associated with an Apple ID. Okay, then what's my Apple ID? They sent me email after about 30 minutes saying, here's how to change your password. Okay, I'll change the password, but I still need to know the Apple ID because you won't let me go into the store to buy the music until I give you that. I could not get that information out of them. All they would tell me is I don't have an Apple ID and I can't get one because that email address is already associated with an Apple ID. So I realized after doing that for about 45 minutes that this was a complete waste of time, and I wasn't even assured that the music I got from iTunes would be DRM free and might only be able to be played on a certain machine, and then I'd have to access all kinds of other things to get it to play on a second machine. All I wanted was the MP3. It was insane. It took over an hour just to get this music downloaded, but eventually I went to a site called mp3million.com, and there I found it. Instead of for $9.99, I found it for $1.07, and I quickly downloaded. I had an account there already. I hadn't used it in years, and I downloaded it, and inside of a few minutes I was listening to it. And then since I did that, people said, oh, you know what, that was a pirate site. You basically were supporting pirates by doing that. But how do you know that? How this site has been around for many years. And just because they're cheaper, does that mean that they're illegal? And if they're illegal, how could they still be up after so many years? And do we really have to check every single website that we do business with to see that they are in fact legitimate and that the money is going to the right places? Because I bet if we check other sites, the artists are not getting the money, and it's not going to the places that we approve of. So I say if you can find it, then it's legitimate. And if the place is still around, it's not up to you to decide this is something that the record companies endorse or not.
Yeah, I mean, with regards to you not being able to buy it on the U.S. version of the site, it's probably because the U.S. version and the U.K. version are dealing with different record labels or recording groups that have different deals in terms of what music you can get in a digital format.
But it's the dumbest thing in the world.
Why
would they restrict people from downloading an album that's out in this country or any country? They should not be. It's ridiculous rules, and it drives people to piracy.
I don't think that the organization that is granting the license to Amazon.co.uk is necessarily the same as the one in the U.S. So the U.S. label, whatever it might be, has decided, oh, we don't want to allow people to download that. But then the recording group that represents it in the U.K. Said that it's okay. So
it just doesn't make any sense because they lost a customer. They could have made money. They probably lost many customers, and I'm just going somewhere else to get it. And I assume I'm getting it legitimately. I'm trying to get it legitimately. I was the only place I could get it that was not making me jump through hoops. But this is one reason why people opt for what is simplest and obviously free sometimes.
Well, these license issues are definitely insane and have gone on for quite some time, as I'm sure we all know, with whether it's movies or whatnot. But what I probably would have been very tempted to do would have been to legally pay while still breaking the license. Probably would have just thought of using a UK-based proxy and then pay for it.
Yeah, I could have done that too. That's a lot more hoops to jump through as well. It probably would slow things down.
You could have bought the CD and then pirated it for the instant enjoyment.
Yeah, I could have driven to a store and gotten it quicker than what I had to go through there.
Yeah, and the thing the record labels and all these old school organizations and institutions that have all these labyrinthine contracts where you can sell it in the UK and not the US or whatever. None of these entities have really realized the technological reality of the situation, which is in this day and age, the only way to have any control over your content is to be the best provider of it. If people want your content and they can't get it from you, they'll get it elsewhere, and then you've lost whatever control you have.
See, that's also that speaks to what we've been doing at the magazine, where we just did the whole volume one thing. We know people can scan things and pass them around, but we think we do a better job where we actually make it look good and we explain what's going on and we make it DRM free. And yeah, people want that. If you do a good job, people will come to you, and you basically have to make it appealing. Otherwise, you're going to lose people.
I'm curious about this distinction you draw between sites that you don't know where they got the data and you pay them a dollar, and sites that you don't know where they got the data and you don't pay them a dollar. I'm not clear why you think the first is in any way superior to the second.
Well, let me ask you, the sites where I pay $10 and I don't know where they got the content, how is that any better?
Well, I mean,
it's not up to me to make that decision.
I think it's up to the consumer to know where the goods he or she purchases come from.
Okay, how do I find that out? How do I go to Amazon and say, where did you get this MP3? How do they give me that information?
They show you right there what record label they do business with.
How hard is it to just say what record label it is? I mean,
the other thing is Amazon's a huge company subject to U.S. law, and they would get sued if they were violating the law too much.
As would this other company, which has been around for years. So I don't see why it's up to me to prove that they're legitimate.
I don't think it's up to you, but I don't understand why you think this is in any way better than just downloading it for free from somewhere.
Because I'm paying for it, and hopefully the money is going to the right people, and it's not up to me to determine that it is. What's that, Bernie?
I said, ha, how much do you, I mean, I would be willing to bet that none of the money you paid for that went to the artist.
Well, how about if I buy it from Amazon? What would you bet then?
Probably almost as little.
Well, okay, so what's a consumer to do then? I mean, it's not up to consumers to figure out where the money is going. It's up to the record companies and the artists to work all that out. And if somebody is doing something that is not kosher online, I assume that the authorities will come after them. The authorities have not come after MP3 Million, so they must be legitimate. That's the only assumption that I can make.
And authorities aside, what your purchase did when you paid money for that MP3, is it rewarded the agency or the entity who was able to provide to you what you wanted?
Exactly, and they deserve that because they provided a service where everybody else was refusing to. And that's my point. And maybe, you know, maybe in this particular case, they've eliminated middleman and all that money goes to the artist. I know that's very unlikely, but maybe there's more of a chance of that. Maybe the same amount is going to the artist because they eliminated the middleman. Who knows?
Do you believe that?
I don't know. I don't know.
No. But what do you think?
It's not up to me, Mike. It's not my, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a record company executive. I'm a consumer. I just want to buy the product. All right. And if somebody sells it to me and someone else refuses to sell it to me, I'm not going to buy it from the people who refuse to sell it to me. Obviously.
But you're an unusually educated consumer. You must have a guess.
I wouldn't say that.
So look, if you go on Craigslist and someone's selling a bicycle on Craigslist and it's a fancy bicycle and it costs
buy a bicycle on Craigslist.
Because you assume it's stolen.
No.
Because it's 50.
Because I want to ride it first. Okay, it's a bad example.
If someone's selling a fancy bicycle on Craigslist for $50, you assume it's stolen, and if you're an ethical person, you don't buy that bicycle.
Well, first of all, I'm amazed by how much bicycles sell for these days. People pay over $1,000 for a bicycle. I would sooner guess that they're worth about $50, to be honest. But I don't know that much about how much bikes are worth these days. The point is, I don't know how much an album that's 40 years old is supposed to cost in the first place. Online, $1.07 sounds about right, to be honest. But we've basically programmed ourselves to believe that $9.99 is fair. You know what? $9.99, I can get the CD too. So how is that fair? But we accept it. Maybe someone else has found a solution where they can sell it for what it's actually worth, and the money actually goes to the right place. I don't know. Like I said, it's not up to me.
What if I offer to sell it to you for 10 cents?
So what?
Would you suspect that I'm giving those 10 cents to the artist or not?
Well, I don't know. Are you offering? Is that what you're offering me right now? I already have it, so I don't need it. You know?
Some other album that
I don't
you want.
Know what kind of deal you worked out with the record companies. It's not up, like I keep saying, it's not up to me to make that determination. I'm the consumer, all right? And if somebody is offering a product and they've been offering it for years at a certain price that's much lower than what everybody else is offering it, they must have figured something out. Right. Either that or they're the mastermind of criminals and nobody can touch them. But in this day and age where the U.S. is able to go into any country and shut down any website, it seems hard to believe that these guys are just doing this with impunity.
All right, well, you know, I'm going to be a little radical here and say if you're worried that where your money might be going to might be paying, stealing from the artist, how about just not giving money to these so-called pirates or including record labels and go to places where you'll find indie artists selling their music directly. Support that, and maybe you'd see the large labels wither away as they realize that their old model doesn't work anymore, and then you would know where all your money's actually going.
You know, I would have called Bob Dylan on the phone and given him the $1.07 directly. How do I know he's not the one behind all this in the first place? I don't know how it works. I just wanted to listen to the music. In fact, I'm going to listen to the music again because... Yeah, now you're all part of the conspiracy because this might be something completely pirated that was downloaded illegally, but we may never know. How do you determine something like it? Sounds just like the other one, doesn't it? Yeah. Of course, I wasn't able to get the other one, but I imagine it sounds like this.
Wait to see if the record label contacts you.
Yeah, but they'd have to be able to even prove that anything was amiss. But I don't know, Bernie, what do you think about all this? Do you listen to music?
I do.
It's getting very complicated.
It is. It is definitely much harder to buy music legally than to just find it for free. I've bought music, paid for it, and other times when I've been frustrated, I'll just download it from some site that has it for free.
Oh, you see, I'd never do that. I would never do that, Bernie. That's
it was a while ago.
That's quite an admission there. Yeah, because I know if I'm downloading for free, nobody's getting paid anything. So, it's...
But they're not anyway.
Well, we don't know that. Unless you can show me books. How can you prove that no one's getting paid anything?
Well, like Rob said, that the people who provide their content better yeah. than anyone else is where everyone goes. You know, if you make it easy, people who are willing to pay will pay. But if you make it really hard and have this crazy labyrinth that one must travel through in order to get the content, they'll go elsewhere.
Mike, let me ask you this. If MP3 Million had charged me $9.99, would you think that it was legitimate then?
No.
Well, why? You just don't like that site?
I've never heard of it before. I have no way to know if it's
legitimate
or not.
So because they haven't advertised and you haven't heard of them, you assume they're legitimate.
So what I could do is I could Google them. I could find out a little bit of information about them. I don't think that, and you normally don't think, that staying ignorant is a great thing to do.
How is it staying ignorant to simply buy something on the net without doing all this research into every single company you do business with? That seems like a big waste of time.
We just spent 10 minutes talking about it. You could have spent 1 minute Googling them.
Yeah, but
you profess to be a journalist.
But I did Google them. That's how I found them in the first place. And I find people using them. And I have not found anybody saying that they're doing anything illegal in the first place. So I don't know why we assume that just because they're not part of the major record industry that they're doing something illegal. They might be the legitimate ones. The record companies and the big companies might be the illegitimate ones. That's my point.
They may also be only legally allowed to provide the service to a certain region of the world to which that license applies, and mm-hmm. you as someone outside of that region, much like Amazon, wouldn't sell you the track from the UK. You may be not actually entitled to use their license in terms
but
of
I did, and maybe
I understand that you did,
maybe they're down
but
the
that
block
license,
from me. I don't know where they are. They could be anywhere.
The business is registered in Cyprus and the license is from the Ukraine.
Really?
Yes.
You just found this out now on your smartphone?
It's on their website.
Okay. Well, like I said, I'm not going to do all this research every time I buy a damn MP3. It's a little insane. And you have to assume, we've been talking about this for weeks, how every time the United States is offended by some website someplace, they take it down, or
right.
they have the people sent here to face charges. This site has been around for years, so I don't think they're doing anything illegitimate. Prove me wrong, but no one has done that yet. That's my point. I don't want to spend the whole show on this. I do want to read some listener letters and then take some phone calls. 212-209-2900. I really thought this would only take a minute to tell the story, but apparently it's a hot issue. Okay, big fan of the show. Your discussion about how technology is sometimes at odds with human interaction struck a nerve with me. I'm a dispenser of adult beverages, in parentheses, bartender, at a large convention hotel. Why is everybody in this room on their smartphone? What are you guys doing? What's going on?
We're probably chatting amongst yourselves.
What's going on?
We're probably all doing research in this MP3 million.
You know what? It's that topic's over. We're moved on to something else. It's no longer even relevant. All right, I continue with this letter here. I so long for the days when the bar was a place for people to meet and talk. It really ties into here, too. Radio shows used to be like that as well. It is not uncommon for me to have every seat filled with nothing but the house music to break the silence. Everybody's busy on their PC or smartphone, giving off an air of do not disturb. I have seen couples out on a date ignore each other in favor of these devices. I would be eternally grateful if your TV-begone friend, i.e. Mitch Altman, would come up with a PC, tablet, smartphone version. the end of humanity is near when people stop interacting in bars. Thank you, Tom, for that amazing letter. And yes, it's so true.
I should point out that Mitch's TV-begone does work on certain MacBooks.
It does. I kind of feel that would be presumptuous, turning off people's phones and computers. But, boy, it does get annoying lots of times when everybody is just lost in that world. And that's what I was speaking out against last week with the Google Glass idea, where people would have altered reality, I guess. What's the actual phrase?
Augmented
reality, where basically you have icons in your field of vision and you're communicating with people that aren't actually in front of you all the time. Could be in contact lenses, could be in glasses. It doesn't exist yet, but people seem eager to jump into that world. And, I'll play with it too, but I think it's really a dark place to go and live your life.
Well, anyone could build an electronic Began if they really wanted to, but it wouldn't be very nice because the electronics basically would never turn back on again.
Okay, another letter. I love your show. I'm working on a project that might interest you. I'm trying to fix the problem of ebook licenses that prohibit legal sharing. I have found a solution that aims to satisfy readers and copyright holders. I plan to do this in two phases. In the first phase, I will create an ebook lending social network for public domain works. Once I have done this, I will convince authors and publishers to adopt a new ebook license that will allow sharing of copyrighted ebooks through the site. My goal is to make sharing ebooks more like sharing print books. You can find more details about how sharing copyrighted ebooks will work on my Indiegogo campaign page, which I don't believe you gave us the URL to. If you like the idea, I hope you'll share the link. And if you give us the link, we'll share it. Thanks to Greg for sending that out. His Twitter ID, maybe you can figure it out from that, is rebookshelf. And yeah, this is something that we've been pushing as publishers. We want to see this. We want to see people being able to borrow ebooks just like they can borrow real books and basically share information.
Aren't there some schemes in place already for libraries to do this? I don't know the specifics.
There are, but there's all kinds of restrictions, and they have to pay a lot of money for them, and they expire. Things that don't happen with real books.
I wonder if it's cheaper, though, than having books that nobody checks out take up room on the shelves.
I don't know. I'm not a librarian, so I don't know this kind of thing.
Well, it probably would make sense to have some sort of expiration date, just like when you check out a book from a library, it's only supposed to be out for a certain period of time when you're supposed to bring it back. No. Instead of electronics, they could easily enforce it.
Can you imagine having to pay a late fee on an ebook that you didn't return on time? Wow. That could add up. All right, our phone number is 212-209-2900. And we'd like to hear who's out there and what's on your mind. Let's take our first phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up, please.
Hi. Okay. I read a while ago about during the Vietnam War that they used water pumps to get water. And the ones that had been made in the recent years right around the war tended to break down frequently, and the ones you could really rely upon were the ones from the French colonial years from the 40s and 50s.
Really hope you're getting to a point soon.
Well, the point is that, thank you, earlier you were talking about reliability of older equipment.
Ah, okay, old equipment, that's how it ties in. I wouldn't be that surprised.
Well, Look, something that was made 50 years ago and is really flaky and doesn't last 50 years, you're not still using. So sort of by definition, anything old that you're still using is pretty long-lived.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, please talk to everybody there. Bye-bye. All right.
Thanks for that. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This is the engineer. I wanted to talk about the cell phone thing.
That's your name, the engineer?
That's my name.
Okay, go ahead.
I want to talk about the cell phone thing. A few things. I don't believe that the bandwidth of a cell phone was ever 300 to 4,000. That's the bandwidth of a real phone. And the other thing that cell phones have done to us is, or I should say the cell phone companies have done to us, is they've thrown away years of ergonomics. The original telephone was designed so a human hand would work it properly, and the damn cell phones, more than I would otherwise accept, are forcing us to serve the phone rather than the other way around.
But I hear babies are being born with different shaped heads now to more suit cell phones.
What, they have a flat spot?
It's getting to that stage. It's going to happen in 1,000 years. Just look at what humans look like, and you'll be amazed.
No,
the guy that's on, the other guy that's on the line, where does he have his info about the old cell phones having higher bandwidth?
Well, I know that because I work in the industry. I'm talking about the analog cellular phones, the old AMS, the Advanced Mobile Phone System.
Oh, okay.
The fidelity of them was even better than the landline instruments. It was superb.
Better than 400 to 4,000 or 200 to 4,000?
Yeah, actually, the radio channels they operated on were 30 kilohertz wide, FM, wideband FM.
Okay, Bernie, calm down there.
the two might not be related, but yeah, okay, I'll accept that. And then I have zero knowledge about that. But in terms of the cell phone itself, the digital cell phones that we're now using, right, the parameters they've chosen on the codec are deliberately horrible as you guys said.
When they started with digital cell phones, the codecs gave you much more bandwidth, and then they started squeezing that to be lesser and lesser.
Did they really?
Yes, they did.
See, if I can open this up to something else, I hear the same arguments with regards to music, where basically people decry CDs thinking that they don't have the same amount of audio response as vinyl, where basically digital can encompass all of this, but it's just not given that amount of frequency response.
Well, it depends
Am I correct?
On what they, how they cheat. If you look at digital television, leaving aside the problems that were identified, and I think it was Electronics Magazine, about the relative unreliability of their transmission scheme, they have the opportunity to have an HD channel or multiple channels of lo-fi. So they go with multiple channels of lo-fi, more advertising.
More advertising.
Yeah, wrong guys own all the factories, okay, guys? It should be us, and then this wouldn't be a problem. But anyway, and talking about old equipment, the other fellow talked about old equipment. There seems to be a U-shaped curve in the design of any quote, technology. I hate that word. In the beginning, you're trying to get it under control. Then you've got it working, and you've really made it high quality. Look at vinyl records. Then you start looking at it from a profit point of view, and you say, how can we shave this off? How can we cut corners and make more profit? So the original records were shellac. They had problems. 78, a lot of noise, blah, blah, blah. Then they got into microgroove. I have some microgrooves here to date from the early 1950s, spectacular frequency response and all of that stuff. They were actually made well. And then they started degrading. Then they introduced the floppy vinyl. The floppy vinyl is actually cheaper to introduce, so it was higher quality. And you actually had higher quality sound. Then they started cutting back, and then it was decreasing in quality. Did the same thing with CDs. Original CDs had problems with lousy ADD converters, blah, 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 blah. They may have sounded harsh. I only hypothesized this from other people's writings. I didn't check it myself. But then you get to the middle ground, the middle period. The CDs are going to be higher quality because, I mean, look, the engineer's working. They want to make good quality. They have the best A-to-Ds, blah, 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 blah. And what's going to happen next is they're going to start cutting back or have already MP3s.
Terrible.
In a related way, are cutting back. By the way, gentlemen, I need people to do this experiment. I haven't had time to do it myself. I will. I've been experimenting with the lame freeware MP3 encoder, and I've been making MP3s of the indie band that I work for because we put them on the website. Somebody has to do it. It's me.
Okay.
Lame allows you to check for clipping in the waveform. The algorithm apparently goes into clipping, especially when you reduce the bit rate of the MP3. In experiments I did so far, with a waveform that was not loud enough in the original waveform, it was an old school CD transcription of an old hippie rock band. So they didn't record their songs with a lot of compression. It wasn't high level on the in the master tape. And so I had no clipping detected. And then I took the MP3, decoded it again, and compared it to the original file, looking to see how much distortion was there. While the distortion was 40 dB down, it wasn't that bad. And it isn't bad enough, my hypothesis, to explain what I hear when I listen to a commercial MP3, and I go, gee, that sounds really harsh around the edges. So I'm thinking it might be clipping. Because nobody I know, including all the guys in the studios that I go to work in, when they make an MP3 off their thing, they never once go through the iterations to find what Lame does, that the algorithm is clipping. So we have to check this out. It may very well be that the reason commercial MP3s sound as bad as they do is because the original material goes through a hard knee limiter, right? You always try to make your master tape sound loud. So you push it up to the edge, and you can see it in a wave editor. You see how it's a solid block of color in most commercial recordings. That will cause the MP3 algorithm to clip, even in the very best, but certainly in the lower grades that they sell you. And so what you really may be objecting to is not the actual distortion of the algorithm or the compression algorithm, much as I hate it. You may be objecting to the clipping introduced by a lousy production of the MP3.
Interesting. Well, listen, we do want to look into that, and that's something fascinating. Raise a number of very good points. But we do have to move on. But thanks for that call, and please stay in touch and let us know what you find out.
I really have to question this claim that the Amps cell phones were somehow awesome audio quality. Anyone who ever used one can tell you how staticky they were in all but the best circumstances. They were incredibly expensive to use and run because the capacity of the network was not very high.
Well, expensiveness does enter into the voice quality, though, does it? Maybe they were more expensive, yes. But the
quality of an amp cell phone was not very good, like in all but the best circumstances.
If you take away the static, right,
which you can't do.
Well, if you have a good connection, I imagine you don't have static, correct? And when you actually are talking to somebody and hearing their voice, I don't know. I never had an Amps phone. Bernie, you had an Amps phone, correct?
I had many of them, and when you had decent signal quality, it was far and above better than what we have today.
Also, we have no time to go into it, but when you get into the subject of professional album mastering today versus years ago, look up the loudness war on a web search or Wikipedia. It's a huge subject and various reasons.
And by the way, just to further touch upon the whole MP3 controversy thing that we're talking about tonight, you know, I've heard it said many times. My ears are not that sensitive, but I do notice a difference. That MP3s are maybe a tenth the quality of what you would get on a CD. Yet somehow we pay the same for MP3s as we do for buying a CD. So when I find a site that's a tenth the price, maybe I'm paying the right amount. I don't know.
I just want to jump in a little pet peeve of mine, this whole HD thing. With audio, it's called hi-fi, not HD. Uh-huh. That's all.
All right, let's take one more phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi, Radio Walk. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to open up a new wound. I was hoping we were going to hear a little more about Richard and Julia O'Dwyer. And I was hoping to call that at night and ask, why would Britain send a whole flotilla of ships? They lost the Antelope, the Sheffield, the Sir Galahad, all to protect 50 citizens and 2,000 citizens on South George Island.
What? What are we talking about here?
Making a direct comparison of the O'Dwyers to what has happened in 1982. It started in April, and it was a very gigantic and bloody war. It was called the Falkland Islands. And
I'm familiar with it. Okay, well, I don't know if we have time to draw these parallels. Anybody want to tackle this one? Mike, you look very perplexed.
I'm having trouble figuring out the parallels between the Falklands Malvinas situation and the O'Dwyer case, but I can tell you that when there is news in that case, we will be happy to provide it.
Yes, and there is no new news as far as we know, but we will check into that. And you can always listen to our interview with Julia O'Dwyer, who's battling having her son extradited to the United States for crimes that aren't even crimes where he lives. But regardless, we are out of time now. Please write to us, oth@2600.com. We'll be back again next week with all kinds of other fun, exciting conversation. And this outro, by the way, Mike, was downloaded from a big company, so you should be happy.
There we sat, killing time and doing as we pleased. Then a computer virus came along, blew in like a breeze. Before too long, we had a sad old tale of news. Our computer was corrupted by the hard drive crash blues. So we wrung our hands, cried a lot, we cursed it, we streamed, until we realized that I dismayed this wasn't a dream. Me, oh my, this was sure I turned to lose. Our computer was corrupted by the hard drive crash blues. The company said we weren't the style. They said you really times and never liked to back up your files. Ooh, it's so smooth, they never gave us a choice to choose. We get to live with our computer with a hard drive crash blues. So we wrung our hands, cried out, we cussed it, we screamed, until we realized that I dismayed this wasn't a dream. Me, oh my, this was sure our time to lose. Corrupted by the hard drive crash blues. with a hard drive crash blues.
In the preceding program, Off the Hook was brought to you live with portions on recording. We were just discussing off the air what would happen if they could extradite any number of us to countries where certain things are illegal, but quite legal where we happen to live. Boy, would things get interesting. Okay, let's have an ID and then the personal computer show.
Got questions about your computer?
Wow, how about that? Yeah. Yep, yes indeed. WBAI's little computer does it again. Let's try this one. No, not that one either. Did not work. Hey, you guys are computer geniuses. What the hell is wrong with our stuff over here? Yeah, other than it's poorly maintained, about 15 years old, and never has been cleaned out. Other than those facts.
Those don't count.
No.
Hey, Cindy, you know how we can fix that problem?
How?
Let's have a fundraiser.
Yeah, we're going to have one in about a half an hour, I'm given to
understand. Wait a minute. It's now 8 o'clock. No, it's not. It's 42, 43, 44.
Yeah, we've got a few more seconds to waste before we can.
Well, we can waste them, but we don't have more than one fundraiser an hour.
That's true. I mean, in fact, back in the bullpen, some of the engineers were sitting around biting our nails and whatever we do. And 2 seconds. Anyway, we discovered there's going to be a fundraiser before we know it. You're tuned to WBAI in New York, and we hear next the personal computer show, which is on right now. There you go. See?
And good evening, this is Joe King. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show here on WBAI New York. My co-host, Hank Key, is on my right in more ways than one. And in a few minutes, we're going to be introducing a guest to you tonight, Stephen J. Vaughn Nichols, a name you probably know, at least the SJVN part of it, because he has been contributing editor to CBS, ZDNet, Byte, eWeek, Information Week, Computer Shopper, PC Mag, PC World, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, and yes, Business Week too. So he'll be on in just a few minutes to talk with us about IPv6. And if you don't know what IPv6 is, doesn't really matter because half of us don't think it matters and the other half think it's too late to worry about it. It's going into effect in 2 months. Hank, what do we start off the show with while we're waiting for Stephen to get
easy.
On?
Well, that's easy. Stevie DB's not with us. He's on assignment and he's on a remote location. And normally what does Stevie do? He introduces the show by saying today is April the 11th, 2012.
Is it still? Even if he's not here?
Yes. And you know what? I said it correctly.
Well, I always thought that if Stevie wasn't here, he would take the date with him.
You know, many, many years ago, when my son was growing up, he was a young kid, I started him off on a CPM machine. And, yeah, you know, that was sort of like, okay, he played Adventure on a CPM machine. But then he bugged me and says, hey, listen, all his friends got a machine for the masses. And I says, okay, what do you want? He says, I want my Commodore 64. Reluctantly, I bought him a Commodore 64. And about a year after that, his friend, who also had a Commodore 64, failed. And he says, here, you could take this machine. It's broken. He gave it to me. And my son now had two Commodore 64s. And the reason why I brought that up is because the guy who introduced the Commodore 64, well, he was in the news the last week.
Yes, sadly enough, he was in the news. Jack Tramiel, the pioneer in computers, died at the age of 83, which some years ago I would have said was an old man, and today I say, my, he was young. He's probably most famous for, in his life, bringing down the price of personal computers to the point where most people who were interested in computers, at least, could afford it. His business model was a very simple one, Hank. Anytime somebody came out with a lower-priced product, he beat that price. And he at a later point in his life, when Commodore was not doing as well as it might have, he bought up a company called Amiga and came out with a multitasking operating system computer at a very low price. And eventually they all went bye-bye. They are gone. But he shall be remembered by all of us, truly a pioneer in computers. I'll bet you anything that our guest tonight, who's, as I said at the top of the show, Stephen Vaughn Nichols, has something he could add to it. But we'll see when he comes on in a few minutes. Hank, what's next?
Well, talking about passing, you know what won't die at all? That's Windows XP. Microsoft has been trying to put that to sleep a long time ago. They announced that, well, they will continue to provide support for it in terms of patches and so on. And they say the drop-dead date is going to be 2 years from now. So sometime around the little bit after spring, 2 years from now, they said, that's it, kaput, no more. And the reason is because in the enterprise, when I say enterprise, that means in the business environment, there are about 200 million machines that are still running Windows XP. That's a fifth of a billion machines. That's not anything to sneeze at. And if these businesses continue to stay on it, Microsoft can't really ignore it. So we'll see what happens there. In addition to that, Microsoft also announced they are retiring Vista. A very short life on that. And the reason why they're doing it is because, well, there's Vista 7, Windows 7, and Windows 8 is coming out later this year. The release candidate is already out. And they will provide security patches, but if you want support, you got to sign a contract with them if you wanted.
That's a paid contract.
Paid contract.
Hank, we have tonight a guest. I gave a brief introduction at the top of the show. And Stephen Vaughn Nichols is pretty well known by a great many people because from the early days of Byte, he's just been writing constantly. He got kind of hung up in the business of computing, but he still knows a lot about the technology. Sydney, is Stephen on the air right now? Hi there, Stephen. How you doing down in North Carolina?
I'm doing quite well. And yourself?
I wish I was in North Carolina.
Well, it's a lovely day down here around Asheville, North Carolina, I have to say.
Is the Biltmore still standing?
If it's still standing, it's still a remarkable place. There's nothing else like it in North America, and nothing really that much like it in Europe either, outside of some of the great houses in England and in France.
When you stop and think that the Vanderbilt Vanderbilt built it because he wanted to have a country cottage. What is it, about 122-room country cottage?
Yeah, something like that. I forget the square footage, but, I mean, actually, this is a house that you should measure in square acres rather than square feet. The Biltmore house really is quite remarkable. It's the original grounds, they sold off some of it over the years, but the original grounds was bigger than some small European countries. I mean, we're not talking like England or France, but, you know, San Marco, places like that, probably bigger, certainly bigger than Vatican City.
I will say that the grounds were bigger, but so was the budget, bigger than many European nations. The reason we asked you to come on tonight is because there's been a lot of chatter back and forth about a new thing called IPv6, or Internet Protocol Version 6, and a whole bunch of people that I know are saying not to worry, it won't affect you in any way whatsoever, and another whole bunch of people I know are saying, wow, you better get prepared for the switchover, which is going to start in June, because it's really going to foul up anything. Hank has his own point of view, of course, because Hank always has his own point of view.
Well, you know that something must be sinister when they pick the date June 6th.
You know, you'd think that they might remember that is D-Day, after all.
I mean, it's like a conspiracy.
Yeah. I mean, really, I honestly don't know what they were thinking about when they decided June 6th was the D-Day. They could have picked a worse day. December 7th comes to mind as
Well, they'll use that for IP7 when that comes out.
Yeah, exactly. So, to get to the point of the matter is, what's going to happen on June 6, 2012, besides the anniversary of the invasion of Normandy, is that a lot of the big-time ISPs, web companies like Google and Yahoo and Facebook are all going to start permanently offering IPv6 services. And a lot of the vendors like Linksys who make Wi-Fi routers, they're going to basically offer IPv6 in all their equipment.
Let me interrupt for just one second.
Sure.
And some people are going to find this whole conversation a little bit geeky by their standards, but just so that they understand, right now the whole world is running on a thing called IPv4.
That's correct.
And the thing called IPv4, for a variety of reasons you might want to talk about later, but I don't want to go into right now, IPv4 began to run out of addresses. Think of it this way. We have phones in this country that are based upon 7 digits, and then they came up with a 3-digit area code.